Monday, August 27th, LA Podcast. This is Alyssa Walker. Was that good?
Yes, okay. Very, very good. I mean, don't stop now. You're on a roll.
I want you guys to say your own names, right?
Hayes Davenport. It?
Scott Frazier. All in attendance.
Exciting week this week. We have a great show. We have an interview and a lot of news to talk about. Let's dive right in.
Before we dive right in, I would just like to say thank you for... So you discussed my secret wedding with my assembly member. At length, actually.
She must have been one of the first people to find out that you got married.
The way that you were describing it, it sounded like Friar Tuck had spirited Sarah and I off into the forest to like have a secret ceremony.
Well, then we were all worried that like your parents didn't know and maybe they listened to the podcast.
Yeah, I got scared.
Actually wrong on both counts. They were in attendance, but they have definitely given up on the podcast.
Let's talk about the LAUSD board vote that happened this week. We've talked a lot about how Ref Rodriguez resigned after a number of personal and professional scandals from his seat on the LAUSD, the District 5, about a month ago. Since then, there's been some debate over how to fill this seat. Do you fill it with an interim board member? Do you call a special election? When should the special election be for? Any of these decisions have to be made by a vote of the board, which is split down the middle right now between three people that represent more of the interests of charter schools and three people that represent the interests of teachers' unions. So the vote was pretty heated. Yep. What were some of the things proposed in the discussion this week?
So basically, the school board has a couple of primary options that it can do. There was discussion about when to actually do a special election. They had ruled out having the board just replace. I think there was never really a feasible way to do that, given that you need a majority of board members and we have an even split right now.
There's consensus that they would never be able to agree on somebody.
Just to finish out Ref Rodriguez's term. But there is a question of whether or not they would appoint somebody until the special election, when the special election can take place. November was out. There's just not enough time. So the special election is going to be taking place in March of next year.
Some people pitched January, but it was decided that even that was not enough time. 5 months away. It seems like plenty of time.
And also, I think what makes it potentially sticky, the January date, it was said, would actually save a substantial amount of money. But
not just the school board's money, the money of all the charter interests and union interests. Teachers know where their dues are going this year. Basically, they're going to this campaign,
which sucks.
Doesn't that suck? I would be kind of disappointed by that if I were on either side.
It's shorter, but that would save them money.
I know.
But we definitely are looking at the highest profile special election, I think it's safe to say, in the history of the school district.
And most expensive probably in the history of the world.
Probably in the... Yeah, I would imagine so.
I think it's pretty safe to say.
Really hope so. As is frequently the case when you have these types of high profile elections in California, I think it's probably safe to assume that we will see a large number of people trying to push their way through this runoff.
Yeah.
You can get in if you hit a top two slot, regardless of what your party affiliation is.
Yeah.
So we're going to see a huge amount of interest in this. And because the special election is in March with a runoff 2 months later, we're looking at not having any representative for the fifth seat on the school board until June of next year. Almost a full year. That 100,000 kids will be without direct representation.
Yeah. Luckily, there's not anything exciting going on in the LAUSD this year, like an impending teacher strike, potentially. and a massive deficit and a new superintendent. And
but they released the coffee cake recipe. So
oh, I saw that. What was the deal? The people love the LAUSD coffee cake.
Yeah, I guess like this is part of the new superintendent's you know, mission to create transparency within the schools by giving the people what they want.
It was actually amazing to see that like typewritten yes, card from 1954. Yeah,
we should make it.
Good.
Yeah,
let's do that.
We should.
Yes, as you said, there's a potential looming strike by UTLA representing the teachers for the school district. Buettner, who just took over as superintendent, is as we have sort of expected to happen, taking somewhat of a hard line in response to some of the requests by the teachers union. So it is a very contentious time for LAUSD. When is it not, I guess?
We want to talk quickly about a settlement this week that the city approved for a police shooting that happened in 2015. Charlie Africa was his nickname, Kanang. He was shot on Skid Row in 2015. He was wanted for violating his probation at the time, got in a scuffle with three officers when they tried to arrest him. One of the officers said that he went for his gun. They shot him six times. At the time, things played out in a way that has become sort of predictable since then. There were a lot of protests. There were marches from Skid Row to LAPD headquarters. Jackie Lacey, the city DA, declined to prosecute the officers, basically changed the names on the statement that she has now issued many, many times, saying that officers acted in self-defense and didn't do anything wrong. And that she wasn't going to make a case out of it. The victim's family sued the city and was awarded a $2 million settlement by a judge. And now the city council has voted and agreed to pay it out. The dissenting, the no votes from the city council, one came from Joe Buscaino, who was a former LAPD officer and consistently votes on the side of the LAPD. He represents the far, far south, like in San Pedro. And then they voted again for some reason. And Mitchell Englander, the one Republican on the council who represents part of the Valley, also voted no, I guess maybe not wanting to be on record for having voted for the settlement. I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting thing to me how these things seem to work where the LAPD... no officer is accused of wrongdoing.
Yeah.
The DA's office never wants to try any cases of wrongdoing. So basically, it's really, really hard to hold an officer responsible. But the purse strings for this kind of thing from the city are usually pretty open. The settlements flow very freely.
Yeah.
Basically, there are $81 million of legal settlements from the LAPD in the fiscal year 2016-2017. I always think of the shooting of the two newspaper delivery women during the Chris Dorner fiasco. Guy who was shooting officers. Two LAPD officers saw a truck that they thought looked like his truck at around like 4:30 a.m. Opened fire on it and shot two middle-aged women who were delivering newspapers out of the truck. And they got a settlement of, I think, $14 million without even a case tried.
Yeah. I think that what is really staggering to me is, so you have, of course, the tremendous loss of life. The Guardian just put out an article specifically about LAPD conduct and how there have been no... I think it said since Jackie Lacey was elected to the office in 2012, there have been no charges filed for about 400 deaths in custody mm-hmm. and officer-involved shootings. No charges whatsoever for any of the officers involved. So there's a tremendous loss of life that is staggering. And then, as you're saying, the just sheer brokenness of a system in which the easiest thing for politicians to do is say nothing about it and just continually throw money
at it.
Yeah,
it actually reminds me of how they handle street repair.
That's what I was just gonna say. All the money that goes to pay out people who get hurt on the streets.
I think something that we see mirrored in a lot of different aspects of civic life in LA, and it is just ridiculously broken. We have a settlement here. I'm actually wearing my shirt from a conference I went to about it right now.
This is a classic Scott shirt, a heavy rotation Scott shirt.
It's like the most comfortable t-shirt that I own.
Can I narrate it? I mean, it says stop tripping.
Yeah.
Tag LA sidewalks investing in place. Get it?
Stop tripping. So there was the Willett settlement where basically the city of Los Angeles was in such egregious violation of the Americans with Disability Act in terms of just allowing sidewalks to fall into major disrepair to the extent that people with disabilities cannot reasonably be expected to be able to get around the city, that the city of LA agreed to pay $1 billion over the course of 30 years in order to do sidewalk improvements that they had just not done. So like we have this model where you have upfront political stasis and politicians who do not want to essentially put their own credibility on the line for any particular issue. And then the taxpayers just have to send money out after the fact because this is not a reasonable way to run a city.
Mm-hmm.
But at least the sidewalks, I guess the money went to actually fixing the sidewalks instead of, say, some payout to one person, for example.
Oh, yeah.
How could that be addressed in this type of way through the LAPD? Could we put that money into training to not kill people? I mean, I don't know what that looks like.
No, because that actually gets you back into the like politically entrenched.
I think they did make some vague reforms after the Kanang shooting.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of how they handled, he suffered from mental illness and was having some kind of episode.
Well, that's a perfect example of how we deal with the homeless crisis, you know, on our streets right now. Yeah. The first responders are police, and that's not the right way to deal with people who need help.
It's really not. I just think that in order to actually do the kind of reforms that you're talking about, Alyssa, like you would need to, as a politician, be willing to place the blame for this on police interactions, and I don't think that we've seen a lot of appetite for that.
But, and I'll say the $1 billion payout did go to fixing sidewalks, but on top of that are hundreds of millions of dollars, I assume. What's a rough number for how much the city pays out in settlements for people that get hurt?
Oh yeah, the LA Times just did an investigation. I think it looked at the year before on the number of bike payouts that had gone out.
You had mentioned previously, I think maybe last week or the week before, that we basically only do street safety improvements when somebody dies. And that is something where the city attorney's office and the administrative officers look and say, this is a place where we have a lot of liability and we're going to pay out a bunch of money. And that's like the only way that we can
That's the only way that anything ever gets changed is if somebody actually dies. So if you want to compare how much money we pay out, the sidewalks are getting fixed from that one particular effort. But for example, last year, the LA Times did an investigation and they paid out just for bike injuries and bike deaths, $19 million just last year.
Wow.
And that was a huge increase from the year before. And one of those examples actually in that story is a perfect example of, how broken our city is. A person who got injured on the Griffith Park Boulevard bike lane, not even actually where the bike lane was, is getting a payout, and the city attorney wants to take out the bike lane, not actually repair the street so it would be safer.
Yeah, and I actually remember there was something about when the city was looking at grading all of the different parts of its road network, there was a city council member who was saying, we should actually remove all of the bike lanes from anywhere that the, because we don't want to encourage people to ride bikes if they could get in an accident and then sue the city.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just think you don't want to make this all about economics, because really the bottom line is that people's lives are being ruined and people are losing their lives and their loved ones.
But I feel like it's this, the city, in a way, the way we do these things, that has made it all about money. Money is the thing that makes these problems go away, not any other kind of reform.
And that's the only resolution that we ever get or see in the news, is that so Africa's family here gets a monetary payment. They can't get their loved one back. But I think it's egregious from a political standpoint that we are really stuck in this cycle of not addressing the root causes of these issues in any meaningful way. And we're just saying, like, well, it's just a payment that goes out at the end of the day.
Yeah. Speaking of getting stuck in cycles, let's talk about Tejon Ranch. This is a new development. I didn't know too much about this story. Scott sent me a big LA Times article about it today. But Alyssa, you've studied it a lot more. This is essentially a new utopian housing development that's going up in north LA County.
As north as it goes.
On a massive property. And this is something that has been done a lot in the history of LA. Talk about Tejon Ranch.
Yeah, I guess you can argue this is what our city is built upon. The ethos of our city is to just keep building and pushing out. There's been actually a few of these in recent years. There's been, this one has been proposed, and another one called Newhall Ranch. And I just want to talk about that one first, because that one's gotten approved or partially approved, I think. It's the same thing. They're really pushing these housing developments as a way to find more supply more affordable housing. Their argument is that the land costs and all the other costs, construction costs, are too expensive in the city of LA. It's really important for people who want to be able to maybe buy their first home, to, you know, they need to look a little bit further out. So this is how they sell it. And then they add all these big environmental pluses to it. They add maybe some job centers, for example, maybe a corporation or something moves out there. And then the big thing for Newhall Ranch was that they pushed it as this net zero development, which basically it will produce or collect, as you know, more energy than it uses, and maybe dump some back onto the grid. So it has solar or whatever else. But the reason, like, I'm kind of okay with that kind of development, we'll talk of the pros and cons about, you know, these types of developments, but Newhall Ranch is has access to Metrolink. So if people wanted to get back into the city of LA, you know, maybe you want to go move out there and never really come back to the city, and that's great. But at least you'd have a chance to take Metrolink, and they could beef up Metrolink service to serve the people. This Centennial development at Tejon Ranch, it has no rail connections and no real plans to connect to, you know, it would be an expensive expansion if they wanted to try to do it. And, you know, right there on the site, you look at it and it's like, oh, we're doing all these great things. Driving traffic improvements is on the page. So they want to just say, you know, we're incentivizing people to drive to this, even if it's like a super sustainable development.
And I assume that doesn't get factored into the calculation of it being like a net zero development.
Yeah, net zero is just really about the, you know, the buildings themselves, the power usage, or whatever. Yeah. But the other thing I think is it's so far away. you could even work in like Kern County, which is such an interesting thought. So maybe, you know, there's some people who really need a place to live and want to be able to commute the other way, and there could be transit connections eventually added, like buses or something. But this is exactly the kind of development we do not need to be doing right
now.
So
doesn't SB 375, the California law that sort of demands that new housing development take into account the transportation facilities that exist and the region's goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, doesn't that sort of suggest that you really shouldn't build something here? I feel like, to me, when I read this, I felt like it was the responsibility of SCAG, the Southern California Association of Governments, to look at a development like this and say, this is really out of step with both the times and also what we're trying to do as Southern California, as a state. And yet Hassan Ikrada, who is the head of SCAG, is in here talking about how this is actually something that he sees as a continuing part of the development strategy in Southern California. He had a quote where he said, there will not be enough land and not enough cities around to accommodate the growth within transit quality areas. It's not only physically impossible, it's also politically impossible, which to me seems like an extremely backwards argument. Also, it's not physically impossible.
No, it is physically possible.
It's very possible.
City of LA is 80% single family zone now. Right. That's a lot of space for people if you started to build up on a lot of those properties. Politically impossible? Maybe. I mean, I don't dispute that. It's hard to put more people in the LA basin, and because all the neighbors fight it
because of the politics. But as an agency, like SCAG is supposed to exist to sort of supersede and corral the various political interests of these smaller cities, and not just be
shrug.
Like, well, it's physically, you couldn't possibly fit any more people in the city of LA, so I guess we have to go out to Bakersfield. That's ridiculous. And I look at this development as being something that, like you said, Alyssa, is never going to be meaningfully served by the transportation facilities that we're building, and it would be extremely expensive to even try to do so.
And you know, this was proposed a long time ago, and I think it said 20 years ago, and it's still, it would be 20 years out maybe before it would even happen. And 20 years from now, the world is going to look very different, and our hopefully we will still, you know, we would not have been subsumed by fire. That's why they're concerned, actually, fire, now that I think about it.
Yeah.
Building in these exurban communities really exposes them to a lot of risk, and water, all the basic elements of life and death. But I think the thing that you brought up, a good point about, like, should we be kind of like incentivizing better growth? And this was something that, for example, SB 827 didn't really address. It was saying, like, you know, we could upzone around these transit corridors, but it doesn't have like the other side of really trying to stop a development like this that has no benefit to, you know, all these emissions goals and all these other mm-hmm. things that we're trying to solve. I saw this, you know, we talk a lot about where to put the people and the political will, and that, you know, we know people are coming, want them to be along transit. And there was a really interesting presentation by Tom Main, the architect Tom Main, who has come up with this concept of putting 1 million extra people just along Wilshire in the city of LA, which, and the other cities that are along Wilshire, which actually makes a lot of sense because there are already a lot of super tall buildings along Wilshire. And you would, if you put a tall building next to a tall main that's already there, you've got the purple line and the red line. That's a great solution, and that would add 1 million people. This is trying to add, you know, what, like 20,000 homes.
Yeah.
And I think the Newhall Ranch one, it also wants to eventually add that many homes as well. That's a staggering amount of people who are going to have to rely on their cars. And we just don't want them to. Like, we really want to give them some options. And I know we can't, like, force people to move into this dense Hong Kong like Wilshire corridor that I'm envisioning in my mind, which, if you should check out Tom Main's proposal, it actually looks pretty cool.
And the demand is there.
People want to live there. But then there's always these arguments from people who are saying, you know, we there's so many people that don't want to live in the city. There's people who don't want to live in dense areas. But as I would argue, we still have plenty of those neighborhoods for people to move into. We could just slightly upzone them in the valley, or, you know,
we are not running out of space.
Yeah.
and so I want to talk about just like some of the actual costs of this, because Catherine Barger, the only Republican on the Board of Supervisors at
for
this
the
point,
county, yeah,
yes, for LA County, who represents this obviously unincorporated area. There's nothing there right now.
Obviously unincorporated. Funny way to describe that area.
So she represents this area, but she has said that, you know, this is private land, and if the developers want to do this, then she's generally supportive of that. But let's talk about what the actual cost is here, because you're talking about dropping potentially 50,000 people or whatever in the middle of nowhere without any public services or anything. So her office has actually told them that if they're going to build this, the developer needs to pay for sheriff and fire stations, medical care centers, public works yard, viable public transit. This is, it should go without saying, very far from the metro service area. Metro doesn't go into the Antelope Valley at all. So you have to basically build public infrastructure from the ground up. Even if the developer is doing the upfront capital costs of building sheriff's facilities and things like that, the public is actually going to be responsible for the paying for staffing and fire department. And I'm not a, I think anyone who's listened to this podcast can tell I'm not like a libertarian. I don't think it's bad to provide public services, but I also do believe in the efficient use of public resources. And Alyssa's talking about putting way more people in the Wilshire corridor in a way that would make much better use of existing public investments and existing public employees than dropping a remote outpost of the, shall we say, troubled sheriff's department up in
up on the county borderline.
Let's start fresh.
Maybe they would all get tattoos of little deer, like like the deer,
a little
that,
deer they're displacing from the
instead of
but like a deer skull,
a cowboy deer skull instead of a cowboy skull, like smoking a weird pipe or whatever.
But what's funny about that is everyone talks about the burden on resources when you build in the city. Like if you tried to put a million people on Wilshire, everyone would say
the pipes aren't,
it's gonna flood the sewers, the streets will flow with shit, we can't support this like the additional resources in this area. But nobody talks about it when it comes to the vast amount of resources that you have to spend to account for new developments.
And so, like, sorry,
50 miles away.
Just to, you know, to dig into the mathematics of this a bit, very briefly, because I know that that's very boring, but it makes a lot more sense to spend money on public infrastructure in a tightly constrained space. Part of the reason why LA's public infrastructure, like our water pipes and things like that, is because the city is so vast, and as you expand the city, you're essentially squaring, you know, the amount of area that you have to cover with water pipes and things like that. So it's very inefficient. You end up having to spend a lot more money to keep things in a regular working order. And obviously sending out all of our infrastructure this far north, it becomes hard to sustain that. If you were to just beef up and actually maintain the infrastructure in the Wilshire corridor, it would be a lot cheaper, a lot easier to do.
And what always drives me nuts about the fights against these developments is they try to make it all about the natural land and that we're, you know, there's some kind of animal that has a protected habitat. I mean, that doesn't drive me nuts. I'm in support of like protecting the habitats. But the bigger issue here is climate change. If you are going to make this, you know, trying to preserve this the wild lands through these like parks that are going to come through this development, and they're trying to make all these concessions, just like somebody just like throw like a chart of VMT like at this person
vehicle,
who's like up
vehicle
there
miles
sorry
travel.
Vehicle miles travel, and just say like, I'm so glad you're going to like keep these five trees up, but like these people are going to be driving to the city of LA every day and basically like building like a power plant in your development, even though it's net zero, because they're going to be driving their gas cars so much. Maybe not in 20 years. And they're going to make that argument too, which is also wrong.
I thought it was funny that they want to push that the houses will be affordable in Tejon Ranch within a development that's not going to go up for like 30 years or something like that. They have put price tags on the houses. Very bold prediction that those aren't going to change at all in the next 30 years.
Good. And just as far as like, if you argue, they put jobs there and they say, oh, we have job centers. But in the same article, it says in Santa Clarita, 75% of the residents commute out. Only 25% work within the city.
Man.
So there's no real way you can add enough jobs that like everybody would stay there. No. And maybe like it could be a senior community where seniors just hang out and maybe buy their retirement home. Yeah. I don't know.
So it sounds like a THX-1138 thing where once people get to retirement age, we ship them out to Tejon Ranch. We talk about how beautiful it is.
They don't need you to go be out driving.
There, it's just scorched earth.
They're going to say like, oh, but autonomous vehicles and people can, no. And like, they need to put it closer. Something like this needs to be a lot closer to the city or on rail.
Let's talk about, there was a Measure H report card that came out this week. County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, who has been in the news a lot for other reasons, has been really celebrating the success of this measure. It's the 1 year anniversary of it passing. Or I guess going into action. It passed in March of 2017. It was a sales tax for homeless services. It was supposed to generate about $350 million a year. There were some early hiccups with questions about whether LHASA, the County Homeless Services Authority, was equipped to spend this money at all. But some of the numbers are in terms of the effect that this measure has had, and they're pretty impressive. It says that they have housed 7,448 homeless families and individuals. I don't know exactly how that math adds up. Homeless families and individuals. I'm not sure what the actual calculus of people is. But they are now in permanent housing because of Measure H. And on top of that, 13,524 people entered Crisis Bridge and interim housing funded in whole or in part by Measure H in the first full year of implementation. Including 2,179 individuals who were given interim housing after being released from jails or hospitals. These are pretty good numbers for a measure that doesn't fund any actual new housing. It funds services, but these services are absolutely a way to get people off the street and into housing. And I appreciate that they're measuring the success of this program by how many people have been housed because of it.
Do we have the thing that is one of the most interesting parts of this discussion to me is the ways in which H and Triple H were intended to work in concert
together.
I guess I should say HHH, Triple H is a wrestler. Uh-huh. so we have this coming out from the county. Do we have anything about the success of HHH yet?
So there's a scorecard you can look at that United Way put up on the Everyone In website. So their goal was 10,000 units of housing over a certain amount of time. It's important to note that not one unit has been completed yet, although ground has been broken on several developments. And there are certain council districts where not even this it breaks down. Their goals are this 222 number per council district by a certain date, like 2020 or something like that. And then I guess they'll just do the other, they'll term out, and then the next person has to be responsible for building the next one. So they broke it all up, which is also not quite right because the needs are different per council district, but it was their way of being like, everyone needs to pitch in. So a few developments that were funded by this effort have broken ground, but they haven't been completed yet. I think probably the PATH project in like it's like a Beverly by the Beverly Vermont Red Lion station that will probably come online first. But you know, of course, it takes time to build housing, but recently there was an announcement that they might not get the full 10,000 units out of it because of rising costs for construction and all these other factors. And then the factor that and then there's the issue that a council member can veto a project in their district. They still have this a very strong power to stop something from going up, even if somebody comes to them and says, hey, we've got it ready to go. Like, let's build this. And they can...
One of the things that is striking to me too is that we, as you said, we've seen that like the number of units that they're expecting to be able to build is kind of steadily declining, which is almost to be expected because as the state legislature has talked about for several sessions in a row now, it is very expensive to build a unit of affordable housing for anyone. And it's getting more so as
well. I've seen estimates ranging from like $350,000 to $500,000 per unit.
Yeah. And the longer the housing crisis goes on and land prices continue to rise, it only becomes more and more expensive.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen a lot of people, especially on Twitter, attack the city and county for basically saying they're not delivering what they promised. They're saying they're not going to build as many units and calling it a bait and switch basically by the city, which I think is kind of ridiculous. This is a known issue. I personally,
this was not intentional on the part of the city.
It's a built in part of our politics right now. And without actually making it easier to build types of housing, such as homeless housing, mm-hmm. There's no way to keep that cost escalation in check. The city doesn't really have, well, they have a lot they can do about it, but beyond those kind of measures, they can't independently just stop homeless housing from becoming more expensive.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the takeaway. It's a lot easier to spend money on homeless services than it is on housing. And these numbers are great that they've gotten people into housing, but without the new housing getting built, at some point they're going to run out of places to put people. I'd also like to make an in-the-moment correction that I said the new path setter was in Westlake, but it's in Rampart.
I corrected you right away.
You said Westlake,
and I said it's right by the Beverly Vermont station.
Yes, so, yeah. But that neighborhood is Rampart Village.
I'd say,
right?
Rampart Village. Yeah, you could say that.
Let's prop lock it, drop it. We're up to proposition seven. How are we only at seven? this is a fun one. All year, daylight savings time, summer all year long.
Yeah, it's like it will be just like the Beach Boys mm-hmm. always wanted. a fitting tribute to their legacy.
So this would, what would this do, Scott?
So Proposition 7, this is actually a pretty complicated one from a political standpoint. It is, or I guess I should say from a bureaucratic standpoint. It is a proposition that all it does is repeal a previous proposition, Proposition 12, which was California's Daylight Savings Time Act that we passed decades ago, making it so that California followed Daylight Savings Time back when that was originally in vogue after World War II.
Okay.
And that was our third attempt as a state to actually pass daylight savings time.
We'd wow.
previously done it in 1930 and 1940, and those both failed. So we are looking at, as a state, repealing our popular authority to have daylight savings time, because as time has gone on, we've moved away from an agrarian to a service-oriented industry. Daylight savings time has become it's back sort of in the balance where people are talking about whether it actually helps productivity. The farmers who have traditionally been seen as the people that are most passionate about keeping it in place are a declining source of political interest in the state, and also maybe don't like it as much as it was previously thought that they did. Mm-hmm. But it's associated with a lot of disruptions in people's life and their ability to be productive at their job. It is associated with negative health impacts and car crashes and things like that.
Whoa.
So the state legislature voted to put this on the ballot. Now we're talking about whether or not we, as the state of California, would like to repeal Prop 12. That is actually only the first step if we are going to move to all-year daylight savings time.
I just have to correct you. It's daylight saving time.
Damn it. I've been saying it one way the whole time.
It's a common mistake,
you know, I just like to point it out because it makes me feel superior to people who don't understand. But just go on, you know, it's the colloquial way that we say.
Yeah, this is the people's podcast.
I mean, maybe the next ballot measure can change the name so it reflects what the people actually say.
That would be great. So why are we doing this? Basically, the legislature cannot independently do this. They because this was something that was put in place by a state ballot measure, mm-hmm. it can only be voted on by the legislature if first the populace rescinds the impetus for the legislature to have this in place.
Which is to say, Prop 7 would not change any laws, it would make it possible for the legislature to change the laws.
Yep. And they would need to do so by a 2/3 vote in both houses. But the other wrinkle to that is that if, as has been sort of bandied about in the legislature, they're talking about doing permanent daylight savings time, not permanent standard time. If they wanted to actually do that, currently that is not allowed by federal law. The uniform,
right? The time police,
right? So we have the Uniform Time Act, which went into effect in the 60s, and that was intended to make it so that everybody started daylight savings time and ended daylight savings time on the same day, and set regulations about basically like when that's when the switch would happen,
and then we did change when the day we've changed
when that
time
date.
So much, why not just go to a single time zone?
We've
a global time zone,
just the United States could be on one time zone.
Okay,
we've experimented with a bunch of different ways to manage time across the country and throughout our throughout our country's history, but the way it works currently, as you said, we've set up specific days that everybody switches if they observe daylight savings time. You don't have to. Arizona and Hawaii do not. But if
that's a cool club to be in, like the Arizona, California, yeah. Hawaii club.
The time rebels.
Yeah. The time rebels. So if you
vacation
want
vacation time,
you can opt out, but you cannot currently opt to do it year round. So the federal law would have to be changed before we could do that. However, if the legislature decided they did want to opt out of daylight savings time altogether, they could do that with a 2/3 vote as soon as, or if the, people of California vote for Prop 7.
We pass Prop 7. The next day, California could...
The legislature will
under
not
the
be...
the endless sun. Yeah,
could
the,
repeal time.
The legislature will not be in session the day after the election, but...
Emergency session. That's interesting. I didn't think I had an opinion on this, but I guess I would say yes on 7, just to give us the flexibility to make these decisions. And what you said about car crashes is interesting. What do you think, Alyssa?
The car crash argument, and most, you go to a lot of cities and they will throw that in your face, that that is a big day, actually the single day that the clocks go back, I guess, is a big day for crashes, because people just, they're not used to their commutes change so radically. So that's an interesting, there's a bunch of different other things safety wise, but I like time.
Yeah.
I want more
you
time.
You want more of it.
This is a pro time podcast.
You like time, you want more of it. Yes on 7. I'm a yes on 7. I think that it's a reasonable thing to give our legislators the ability to take us off of daylight savings time. I have actually lived most of my life without daylight savings time.
That's
as
right.
Somebody who spent a lot of time in the precarious wasteland of Arizona. A timeless land. It was actually much harder for me to adjust to having daylight savings time again than it was for me to live without it. So
you should write a book about that struggle.
The the persistence of memory.
Okay. Unanimous vote.
Yeah.
Yes on 7.
Yes on 7.
Oh my God, we have so much that we've already discussed, and now we have an interview.
Wow.
With two LA Times reporters. A beefy episode. We talked to Jack Dolan and Ryan Menezes about the LAPD's drop program, which we have talked about on the show in the past. We will explain it a little bit more in the interview. Scott and I got to go out to the new El Segundo office for the first time. Have you been there yet, Alyssa?
No, I'm not, because they don't have sidewalks, so I can't go.
No, you can't. It's why they moved.
I bet the
so
security.
You cannot go.
Security would not hold you up the way they held Hayes and I up.
There's no way to walk in, really. But we got held up at the gate and our car for a very long time. Really intense security measures. But they were awesome. And we had a great conversation with Jack and Ryan. And now you get to hear it. Jack Dolan and Ryan Menezes, LA Times data reporters. Thank you for talking to us. You guys have published a series of incendiary articles, scorching hot articles, about the LAPD and fire departments drop program.
Also some of the most entertaining reporting that you are likely to read about LA in general this year, I think.
I there's actual laugh out loud stuff. I've never laughed out loud so much reading a piece. Congratulations. Thank you. Let me try and summarize the drop program really quickly. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong. When an LAPD or LAFD employee hits 50, they have a choice. They can either just retire then and start collecting their pension, which is about 90% of their salary. Is that right?
Up to.
Okay. Or they can choose to continue working for 5 years, during which time they can collect their pension at the same time. So they're effectively paid double.
Right.
I learned a lot of this from, are you familiar with the Michael Connelly book,
of course,
The Drop?
Yeah.
Okay, is that what inspired
every
this?
Every editor in this building comes by my desk and is like, season 3, episode 4, they mentioned Drop twice, you know?
Because
like,
Bosch is in The Drop program.
I need to watch it. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. This program was mildly controversial, I guess, at the time that it was enacted in the 90s under Mayor Richard Reardon.
Right.
Can you talk about why this program was set up in the first place?
It was a sort of a cookie cutter program that was being brought up by police and fire unions across the country back in the early aughts. And they would either pitch it as a way to keep veteran officers on the force a bit longer, or if the climate was different, they would say, this is a great way to make sure they leave sooner, right? So you would pick your pitch, right?
Same program.
Because they have
same
to,
program.
Because they have to leave after the 5 years, right? And this is a big problem for Bosch. He doesn't want to retire.
Right.
He loves the work. He's about the work, but you have to after 5 years, right. Supposedly.
Right. Well, supposedly.
Yes. We'll get to that.
Yeah. So that was the deal back in the aughts. And the police union came to Reardon and they wanted to do this program because you get paid double. And the rationale at the time, it was right after the Rampart scandal, which, a lot, you know, if you don't remember, this was cops in the Rampart division of the LAPD planting drugs on people, shooting people. I mean, they were full gangsters, mm-hmm. right? The LA Times broke all these stories about it. And the union's rationale was, well, now we have this wide-ranging corruption investigation in the department. A lot of people are going to leave.
We need a morale boost.
Right.
We need a little treat for what we've been through.
Right. So it's not like we need to crack down on the corruption. It's we need, you know, to boost pay so people will stay. Reardon bought it at the time. He thought it was a relatively easy way to appease the union, and you need the unions to be mayor of LA.
Right.
And you particularly need the police and fire unions. So he did it. Years go by. I mean, it's like, I don't know, 16, 17 years. I started doing this story and started gathering the data and started figuring out what was going on. And I called Dick Reardon. And I said, I want to talk to you about the DROP program. It's this deferred retirement option. And before I could even like spell out the acronym, he's like, oh, yeah, that was a mistake.
And he's got very candid.
Yeah.
And the reason I guess he thinks it was a mistake is what wasn't really widely known until you guys reported on it was how many officers and firefighters enter the DROP program and then take injury or sick leave, sometimes almost immediately, so they collect their salary and their pension to not work at all, and are sometimes very openly at a timeshare in Cabo or trading for marathons, two examples that you guys cited. So, right, I guess, like, how widespread is this kind of behavior within the DROP program?
Well, we were able to get our hands on the time cards of all the cops and firefighters in the city.
Was it a hacking? Did you hack them?
Jack asked very nicely. And, it's sitting on a computer in our office right here. And our top line conclusions were about a third of all cops and firefighters end up taking some form of injury leave once they enter the drop. We were able to, you know, see that they take on average about 10 months off when they do take injury leave, and the costs just trickle down to taxpayers. Someone has to fill their shift. That person gets overtime. They make the person taking the time off makes a tax-free workers' comp benefit.
Okay. So now we're up to like triple or quadruple costs.
If you count in the tax benefits, they're making a lot of money.
Correct. And that's a little known benefit of if you're a cop or a firefighter and you file a workers' comp claim and you then take time off, the salary you get is tax-free. And the way that it, workers' comp, you know, if you and I were to take time off for workers' comp, we would get 60% roughly of our salary up to about, I mean, if you make over $50,000 a year, it's capped. But the notion of it being tax-free is that it kind of makes you whole, right? If you, you know, the cops and firefighters get it tax-free too, but they get all of their salary. There's no, you know, limit to it. So essentially they get their full salary tax-free.
Wow. One of the most amazing things about your reporting, and to me the funniest thing, is how totally unembarrassed so many of the officers who are in the drop program and on injury leave and on vacation seemingly a lot are about doing this. Like we alluded to, you guys found like a couple who were both in the LAPD who were very openly in Cabo San Lucas for most of their time in the drop program. They had a timeshare there. One of the officers, a former captain, I believe, had a self-published autobiography. Who was it that read this self-published autobiography?
That was me.
That was Jack.
It was sort of early on in the reporting of this, and we were trying to figure out like how we were going to get inside the heads of the people who had done this. Mm-hmm. And imagine my delight when one of them had, you know, written like a 300-page autobiography.
Available on Amazon.
Yeah. I had to order it from Amazon and then, you know, like sit there tapping my finger waiting for it to show up.
So that's more money for them.
It didn't sell well. I'm just
gonna okay. And in this self-published autobiography, she details pretty explicitly spending all this time in Cabo. They were helping their daughter set up a film and theater production operation down there. And all the other cops seem very supportive of this. It seems like it's something that's just really built into the culture there. Was that the impression that you got, Ryan?
Yeah, their colleagues for sure knew about it. There's this internal LAPD publication, The Thin Blue Line, I believe it's called. And there were just, you know, these comedic illustrations of the two of them when they retired, openly talking about their time spent in Cabo. So it seemed, you know, that there was no shame from them. You know, the colleagues didn't blow the whistle on them or anything. This was just known pretty widely in the department.
Now, so one of the things that I think is really common, not just in public employment, but in any employment sector, is that employers don't like having to do workmen's comp payouts. And you spend a lot of time doing things like office safety and awareness, things like that. So it seems really striking to me. Obviously, these are two jobs, police and fire, that are potentially dangerous to individuals' health. Do we have a sense of whether or not the injury claims that are being reported by police and fire department employees are being investigated, whether there are in sort of inquests into whether or not these are valid claims?
No, that's incredibly rare. And in order to be in the drop program, you have to be 50, you have to have 25 years of experience. So the nature of the injuries is overwhelmingly something called cumulative trauma. So it's not like I was fighting a fire and the roof collapsed, or I was fighting a combative suspect, you know, and I broke my arm. My back hurts or my knees hurt, which is very valid. I mean, I'm pushing 50 right myself and my knees hurt too. But there's very little that you can do, you know, if somebody says their knees hurt, I mean, how do you prove their knee doesn't hurt?
Yeah.
And the question then becomes like, why did you wait until you joined the drop and were getting paid double to suddenly decide that, you know, you can't work on this knee anymore and you need 2 years off and you're going to run a marathon in Portland?
Right. Yeah, let's talk about that. This is one of the more tragicomic, parts of the first article you guys published in February. And we should also mention that you guys did this in collaboration with Gus Garcia Roberts, who no longer works. He works at USA Today now,
right.
But he was a part of this as well. I believe it was a firefighter, exactly like you said, filed an injury claim for an injured knee. Took a year off from work while he was in the drop program, but then 2 months after filing the claim, seemingly ran a marathon, you guys found a picture of him crossing the finish line where he looks very proud of himself for this achievement and is now being used to expose potential benefits fraud. Who found that? How did you find it?
Gus found him.
And it was
very helpful that he has a uncommon name. There aren't a whole lot of Tom Futterers in the world. He had run a number of half marathons with consistent times. By the way, I run half marathons as well, and that's a telling detail.
It's a tell, yeah.
So when we found the online record of him crossing the finish line of this race in Portland, you know, there was only one Tom Futterer who lives. There were two who live in the country. One lives in Long Beach and is a firefighter. The other guy lives in Texas. And when I called him to ask if he'd ever run a half marathon in Portland, he was just baffled and had no idea what I was talking about.
And he's probably still a little scared about what that call was about.
Right.
Now, so if we could move to our present story a little bit, we gave a little bit of background to our listeners last week on the new chief of police, Michael Moore, his participation in the drop. But Ryan, do you maybe want to speak a little bit about the context for Michael Moore's drop and bounce, something called the bounce?
Sure. So 5 years ago, Michael Moore, now chief of police, entered the drop. And the rules of the drop say that after 5 years, you're supposed to retire. And his 5 years came up in
January.
And we noticed this in the list of drop enrollees. And he, you know, is supposed to retire in January, but in June, he's named chief of police. And we were wondering, how did this happen? How did a guy who was supposed to leave after 5 years come back and then get promoted to the top job in all of LAPD? Turns out he utilized this rarely used mechanism called the bounce.
Sounds like another Michael Connelly book.
This is ripe for another novel. He was called back into his same job at the same pay. And a few short weeks later, he was in the final pool of three candidates for LAPD chief. He was promoted to the top job. And he netted $1.3 million from his pension for doing this. And, you know, the bargain is you're supposed to leave after it, but now he gets to accumulate another salary, keep making money as chief, making even more money. And we asked some fair questions as to why this happened.
So somebody who bounces, that is essentially that the chief of police, in this case, former chief Charlie Beck, says that they need somebody with a certain specialized expertise to continue doing a job that they can't get a replacement for right away. And isn't it that the term of that is that you are only supposed to be a temporary hire?
It was envisioned as a way, say you're a homicide detective, mm-hmm. and your end date of the drop is coming up, but the case hasn't gone to trial yet. And the case is going to fall apart without you because you know the case, right? So they worked into the administrative code. You know, there's this deal, we'll call it the bounce, and you can come back temporarily, no longer than a year. It's just because we need you to do this thing. The weirdness with Michael Moore, the new chief, was that he was doing an administrative job, a high-level administrative job, but an administrative job that everybody in the department knows what it is, knows what you do, right? They had 5 years to plan his succession. And one of the arguments for the drop is, well, it gives us, you know, an opportunity to plan succession.
Right.
So the question is, like, how was it necessary that this, his due date is coming and you guys suddenly panicked and thought we've got to keep Michael Moore around a little bit longer?
Yeah. Conspiracy theorists might wonder if there was an assumption that Michael Moore was going to become chief, but he had to be hired back onto the job after a month of retirement in order to get this $1.3 million payout. He says that it's just a coincidence that it just happened to line up that way.
My favorite was that he says, I understand that it might look suspicious.
Yes, to an outsider.
Also at play here is the fact that the chief of the fire and police departments cannot be in drop, cannot stand to benefit from drop. So Charlie Beck told Jack that he gave back $350,000 that he had accrued because Charlie Beck was old enough and was enrolled in the drop before in 2009 he became police chief and then had to leave drop entirely and give back all of his benefits before he became the chief of police.
But once your drop payment culminates, there's you don't have to give it back.
Once you cash the check.
Yes.
You've cashed the check.
What was the timeline of events in terms of Chief Moore announcing, or at that point, not currently Chief Moore, but when did he announce his retirement? When did he leave the department? And when did he actually become chosen as the new chief?
So the current chief is Moore. The previous chief is Beck.
Beck, correct.
And Moore was supposed to leave. His drop end date was in January. Beck said he went to Moore, and Moore said the same story in October or November. And Beck said to Moore, "Hey man, we need you. We're gonna do that. We're gonna bounce you. I know it's weird. It doesn't happen very often, but we're gonna do this. I need you to stick around." On January 19th, I believe, Beck announced formally that he's going to retire. End of January, Moore walks out the door, collects his 1.3, spends a couple of weeks skiing in Breckenridge and going to visit his daughter, and then he's back in his old job, same pay, and he, you know, there's a lot of jockeying in the LAPD. There were a lot of people who wanted that job. Moore gets chosen in June. And my question to both Beck and Moore was, come on. You want us to believe that you had this conversation in the fall of 2017, and you, Chief Beck, didn't just sort of as an aside say, "Hey, man, come on back. You never know, you know, God knows how long I'm going to be around." They both swear that conversation never happened.
And I just want to say there was a lot of jockeying for this position, but the idea that Michael Moore would be chosen for it was not, he was not an outsider candidate at all. In fact, he was chosen for chief by the panel.
Yeah, the police commission in 2009, the year that Beck got the job, Moore was the top ranked candidate. And Villaraigosa went with Beck instead. I don't know why, but that's what happened. So Moore was not, you know, a dark horse.
Sure. Have you heard, just one final question on in terms of the Moore story for right now? Have you heard?
I have another one.
Oh, okay. So one question from me.
Why I never say last question.
Regarding, I do have some more other questions, but in terms of Moore himself, have you, either of you heard any sort of rumblings from the elected officials in LA who maybe supported other chiefs that they are, they want to know what happened here? Or I know that some prominent city council members, Gil Cedillo, supported Robert Arcos, and seemed a bit put off that that Arcos was not chosen. Have you heard any indication that that there are elected officials who want to find out what's going on?
We've reached out for comment and haven't heard back.
Okay. I have a question about the timeline for you guys reporting this. When Michael Moore was chosen as one of the three candidates for LAPD chief, you guys must have known because of the list, the data that you had, that he had gone through the drop program and gotten this payout. It could potentially, publishing that story while he was a candidate could have made it more difficult for him to be chosen as chief, but it wasn't reported until August. I guess I'm just curious what went into making this a story that you guys could publish.
Well, I mean, we're a human institution. There's having a list and there's looking at the list.
We didn't know that he had retired.
Oh, you didn't know?
No. Yeah.
Ryan and I we looked that carefully at
it's a big list.
Yeah.
It's a very long list. We have a lot of data. And I remember we were like, did he actually retire and come back? This was kind of shocking to us.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So it
was. It was
until
sitting there in the data for months, more than a year, and we had no idea until we took a look at it closely.
And our stories have been about people who, you know, go into this program and then leave for 3 years for Cabo or, you know, the Iron Man, right? And Moore doesn't fit that profile at all.
Yeah. When he was in drop,
He did not take any injury time. So he never stuck out to us in that regard.
Oh, okay.
So it was only after the fact we were looking at the data and we looked at each other like, ooh.
Well, so I guess he can't be too bad at you guys.
So I'm curious now, there was a story in the past week or so that Michael Moore, due to perhaps the scrutiny that he has received from reporters such as yourselves, has said that he would support reforms to the drop program. This has been a topic of discussion in the city now for most of the year. Could you tell us a bit about potential reforms and who is supporting or leading that effort in the city?
Yeah, the Garcetti has come out and said he still loves the drop program. He thinks it's great. But he could imagine that if you go out on injury leave while you're in the drop program, that the pension half of your pay would be suspended until you can come back. So that I know that they are in negotiations with the unions to do that. They're in no rush to do that. They've been negotiating this for months now. But that's what Moore was alluding to. He was saying, you know, we could do a change like that.
Okay.
And Beck has supported that too.
Have you heard any indication from Mayor Garcetti what he thinks are the specific benefits of the drop? If we're talking about a program that was put in place perhaps to either boost morale or retain experienced officers, and it's actually just sort of seeing people walk out the door with a lot of money in hand, but then you have to replace them anyway. Has Garcetti said that he thinks it's accomplishing any specific goals for the police department?
Well, apparently ignoring the fact that almost half of the people in the drop program then go out on injury leave, he still thinks it boosts morale. Okay. And that it retains senior officers.
Okay. I noticed today, actually, Monday, Steve Lopez, he wrote a critical column in the Times recently of the drop program. He called this payment for Moore a windfall. He suggested that Moore donate the $1.3 million to an LAUSD program to help keep schools open later. LAPD Commissioner Steve Soboroff objected to that portrayal, wrote you guys on Twitter that he thought that the term windfall was not appropriate, that the money was earned by Michael Moore. And that Steve Lopez's reference to draining the swamp of the LAPD was an insult to all officers. You responded, Jack, saying that that windfall was kind of a gentle term for this payment.
I think what I said was that, you know, if you're in the drop program, you don't have to work any extra hours for the money. You don't have to do any extra duty for the money. And there is something insulting about that, but it's not the word we chose to describe it.
Right. And yeah, this was a payment. You know, the only penalty of getting this payment is that you're supposed to retire permanently after that, which Michael Moore did not have to do. So it's really just a free $1.3 million, which I think a windfall is a pretty fair portrayal. But does that suggest to you that bodies like the police commission, which would have a role in changing this kind of thing, are not really interested in any kind of reform for the program?
Yes.
Okay.
Whose ultimate decision would that be? Would that be up to the police commission, or who has the final say on the existence of a program like this?
It's Garcetti and the unions.
Okay.
So the unions. Jack, Ryan, thank you so much for talking to us. Anything else you want to say about your coverage? Anything else we can expect that you want to just burn your scoop right now?
No, but there's absolutely more to come.
More to come.
Great. Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Another great interview in the books.
Yeah, from the LA Times' very own podcast studio.
We should say that Mayor Garcetti, we talked about in the interview, had sort of gently floated reforms for the drop program. He has formally announced them on this past Friday. Now they're going to say that drop pension payments will be suspended for any officers who miss a lot of time due to injury or illness. I'm not sure exactly what a lot is. Right now, the average, of course, is 10 months that people take off while they're in the drop program. So presumably it would be less than that. But I don't think we have numbers on at what point the payments would stop, right?
I don't think so yet. But yeah, so Jack Dolan and Ryan Menezes put out this after we talked to them earlier this week. And they basically will continue to follow this story as it comes out. So.
Yeah. Thanks to them. Thanks to Alyssa. Thank you, Scott. Alyssa had to run out before this little postscript here because her ride showed up. But we will be back next week on LA Podcast.